going to make a confession to you this morning. When I'm having a conversation with a stranger, I do not like to tell them that I am a pastor. And recently, on an airplane, a man sitting next to me got really excited when I told him in the course of conversation that I was a pastor. Excitement is not the response that I usually get, so I was playing along. And to my surprise, this guy pulls out a business card, and this little business card contained information about an app that he had just created and was trying to promote. And as he went on to explain, the purpose of the app was to help people locate fitness-friendly restaurants in the places they were traveling to. And I said, okay, yeah, that's interesting. And since I didn't totally stick my nose up at this app, he handed me a huge stack of like 1,000 more of these business cards and said, would you be able to hand these out to people in your church? I said, well, I don't think I quite need all of these, a little sheepishly, maybe just like a couple. And he was disappointed. I guess we weren't the big break that he was looking for or something. So not wanting to take all of the wind out of his sails, I offered to take one business card for myself. So if anybody needs some fitness-friendly restaurants recommendations here in Des Moines, I can dig it out of my dresser drawer at home, maybe. This is the one and only time telling someone I'm a pastor has led to a business promotion. It's the exception that proves the rule. Usually when I tell someone I'm a pastor, it is a conversation ender, not a conversation starter. And I get that too. We know that less and less people want to be associated with Christianity. And we've talked several times over the last 6 months or so about living in a post-Christian culture. Many churches are wondering what their future holds a generation or two from now. And I come to these issues from the vantage point of being a millennial minister. And when I talk to friends and folks in my generation, I begin with the assumption that they aren't active Christians and that they are probably a bit wary of me or what my agenda might be as the pastor. And I assume that because it's been my experience. And that doesn't make my friends bad people, of course. They are good and caring. They're doing their best. They just don't see much reason to go to church. And who's really at fault for this? Them or the church? Have we given people positive reasons to make faith, to make church community part of their lives? Have we communicated why following the way of Jesus matters? These are the kind of questions that keep me wanting to be a pastor, even if I don't like telling people that's what I do. And I'm afraid that the church is known in our wider culture more for whatever it stands against rather than what it stands for in this world. And I think that's true for many reasons, generally. And so as a pastor, but more so as an ordinary person, I long for a church that can celebrate together as a community of seekers, sinners, and saints of all stripes, because we can be all three of those things in one day, let alone one lifetime. And I begin here this morning because the parable of the prodigal son struck me differently than it usually does as I studied and thought about it this week. It's one of the classic parables. From humble beginnings, a father has patiently and carefully cultivated his family business. There were some rough times, but overall he's done well for himself. He's been a good steward of his resources, and he dreams of leaving a large inheritance for his two sons. One day, that younger son comes along and out of the blue asks his father for his inheritance. And it wasn't the appropriate time for this, but the generous father accepts his son's request and gives him his share. And the son takes this inheritance, and instead of investing it or using it wisely, he goes out to Vegas and squanders it. He gambles it all away until there is nothing left. And at this point in the parable, the younger son finds himself literally living among the pigs. In Jewish culture and tradition, this was rock bottom. There was nothing worse, and that's where he put himself, rock bottom. And so life back at home starts to sound pretty good again, and even his father's hired hands, the lowest guys on the totem pole, had food to eat and shelter over their heads while he is going hungry in the pig pen. So nothing can be worse than this. Even having to swallow his pride, own up to his terrible mistakes, and face his father, he plans to head home to confess his sins, to admit his unworthiness, and to start over among the hired hands. And that's what he does. And so for the people who were listening to Jesus, listening along as Jesus was telling this parable, they would have expected the son to make his slow and humiliating walk back home into his father's office. And then they would have expected the father to listen to the son and then scold him to the high heavens. And the father would let his son join the hired hands and begin this long and shameful process of atoning for his wrongdoing, unlikely to ever regain that privileged status that he once had. But that's not what happens. In a twist that shocked Jesus' listeners, the father runs toward the son at first sight, and for an esteemed man, a wealthy father, to run at all was an incredible violation of all the cultural norms that guided Middle Eastern culture. But to run toward a disgraced son while he was still far off was unimaginable. But so what? The father is filled with compassion, and he embraces his son and kisses him. So we're in uncharted territory here in this parable as it is, and it gets further along. The son begins to give his spiel about his sins. He's been thinking about this his whole walk home, and his father doesn't even listen. He doesn't care. He tells the hired hands, go get the robe, the best one, get a ring for his finger, get new clean sandals for his feet. On top of that, get the fatted calf that we've been saving up for a grand occasion and get it ready. We're going to celebrate. My son was dead and he's alive. He was lost. Now he is found. And then the spotlight shifts to the elder son. And what's he doing? He's out in the fields working, like he always does, like he's always supposed to be doing. And he hears this music and this dancing going on in the distance, and he has no idea what's happening, and he asks somebody else. And when he learns, he is immediately angry and refuses to join the party. And when the father catches wind of this, he begs his elder son to come inside, and the elder son has a point. He's worked hard for years. He's done everything that his father has asked of him. And yet he's never thrown a party for the elder son, nothing close to it. But the reality is that the elder son has never been lost. That's the thing. He's been with him the whole time. The father says, all that is mine is yours. It's not like the father is playing favorites. Elder son will receive everything that he was always entitled to. But tonight is a time to rejoice because the son who was lost has been found again. Now, we try our best to interpret these parables of Jesus, but it's always a little tricky. Parables were meant to make us think. Now, the most common interpretation among biblical scholars of what's going on here is that the father represents God, the elder son represents the Jewish people, and the younger son represents the Gentiles who will become Christians. And I think this contextual interpretation makes a lot of sense. The father's embrace of the younger son represents God's embrace and represents God's love, which now expands to include Gentile believers who were formerly lost. So in a sense, Jesus is laying down the framework for what is to come in the future church with this parable. But nowadays, though, we tend to separate the parable from this original context. Prodigals are often thought of as being people who leave the faith, leave the church, and one day may or may not return. I vividly remember when my good friend John met me for coffee one night during spring break. We were college students, and he recently had transferred from this large Christian university to a smaller state school in Pennsylvania. And during our conversation, John told me about his decision to transfer and that it was mostly motivated by the fact that he was no longer considering himself a believing and practicing Christian. And John's parents were devastated. They are two of the most passionate, dedicated, and loving Christians I know. To this day, I felt really bad for them. They raised him up in the church, had Bible studies at their home, a vibrant prayer life, stood next to him while he was baptized. And yet John walked away from Christian faith. And the pastor, our pastor, told John's parents that John was a prodigal. And one day, like the younger son, he would return back to faith, come back to God. And I hope that's true. I hope John is a prodigal. Yet at the same time, I also struggle with this understanding of the prodigal. Because I know that John and many others in my generation and beyond have struggled to connect to the church today. I hear a lot about prodigals leaving the church, but to me, it's the church that is losing its way. Has the church given people reasons to make faith and church community part of their life? Has the church communicated why following the way of Jesus makes a difference in our lives and in the world? Or has the church kept spinning its wheels, doing the same thing repeatedly, and just expecting people to come inside and care? And I ask these questions as a person who loves the church, and this church in particular. And I ask these questions as a pastor in a world that may not need pastors much longer. Now, above all things, the parable of the prodigal son is a radical demonstration of God's love. It is a vision of God's ever-expanding grace. It is not a grace that says, look what you've done. It's not a grace that says, I will love you when you do all of these things. It is a grace that runs toward people at first sight, seekers, sinners, and saints, embraces them and says, let's celebrate. That's what God's love looks like. And I believe that with my whole heart that our calling as a church is to do this. We are called to embody the running love of the Father. But it often seems like we've gotten lost, like the prodigal son. And it breaks my heart when Christians are increasingly known for being judgmental and legalistic, for failing to welcome and provide hospitality to all people, for focusing on the things that divide us rather than the things that unite us. Breaks my heart when Christians smear dominant culture instead of the way of Jesus guided by Scripture and the movement of the still-speaking Spirit. Breaks my heart when Christians are known for whatever they're against rather than what they stand for in the world. And our purpose, the purpose of all churches, is to be God's vehicle in their neighborhoods, in their communities, in their cities. And the journey that we're on here together, which stretches all the way back to the founding of this church, is a journey toward discerning what that looks like today. And ultimately, I believe that is our function. But the question I continue to ask is this: what is our form? What form of church must we be today in order to fulfill our function. It's a question about how we do church. Now, in the late 1800s, architects saw that cities were quickly becoming crowded and growing fast. As industrial work increased, people and buildings were springing up all over the place, and the demand was multiplying. So they had a problem. The function of buildings for housing, for business, for virtually every purpose was desperately still needed, but they were literally running out of room. And the form that buildings had always taken, the way that buildings were always made, was no longer meeting the needs of the people. They were no longer connecting to the new conditions of cities. And that's how we got skyscrapers. The architects found a way to build new structures upward instead of outward. So problem solved. Necessity is the mother of invention, as they say. In modern architecture, this style of innovation became known as this principle. Form follows function. This means the function first, then the form. So you start with the function and then figure out the form that best allows you to fulfill your function. Function of buildings has never changed, but their form sure has. And even though we are always working to do it better, the function of the church continues to be the vehicle of God's love in the world. And God's radical love is needed now more than ever. But I think our form as the church is in desperate need of innovation if we are going to fulfill our function to the best of our potential. How might we begin to transform how we do church together in a way that allows us to live further into our function of being God's vehicle for love in this world? What kind of form should follow our function in today's context? What needs to change so that we can reach a new generation of people? And I invite you to give some thought to those questions. I'll post them on our Facebook page for you to respond. Or you can email me, or better yet, let's get coffee and talk. I do a lot of talking. I want to listen to you. The reality is that I'm searching for answers to these questions too, but I do have some ideas. And here are a few of them. I think the next form of the church will be less fixated on meeting just Sunday mornings. I think the next form of the church will see sharing food and hospitality as an act that is integrated into worship. I think the next form of the church will use their buildings to serve community, not just the church. I think the next form of the church will prioritize a yearly covenant over membership roles and the gifts of people as much as pastors. I think the next form of the church will be unashamed of the gospel and unashamed of the truth that the gospel calls us to seek justice, peace, and reconciliation and to live in solidarity with the poor. I think the next form of the church will be known positively for what it stands for, not whatever it stands against. I think the next form of the church will look less like a modern institution and more like the early church, who gathered to eat together, share resources, and worship wherever and whenever they could. And so, like the first Anabaptist who sought to recover the radical wisdom and way of the early church in their 16th century context, perhaps we need to do the same for our 21st century context. And while the architects who created skyscrapers innovated forwards, the church may need to innovate backward in order to innovate forward, to get back to our roots in order to grow upward and be refreshed for a brand new world. And I believe that this church, Des Moines Mennonite Church, is uniquely suited to continue thriving into the future. We have a long road ahead of us, but we do not find ourselves at rock bottom like the prodigal son was. Far from it. We are not home, but we are not lost. We are not there, but we are going to get there. And we are going to celebrate. We are going to party, and everyone will be invited. Amen.